Welcome back to Focus 580. I'm Jim Meadows, filling in this morning for David Inge. And we have another hour of our telephone talk show. And the subject is not a pleasant one. The subject is torture, something done far away in semi-barbaric foreign lands by twisted, evil people. And hundreds of movies, TV shows, and novels will tell you that. Our guest today, John Conroy, says the use of torture is not that distant from us, that it's done to people in presumably civilized nations, including this one, and that the people who administer the torture are not substantially different from us. Conroy writes about torture in a new book, Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People, The Dynamics of Torture. It's new from Alfred A. Knopf. John Conroy, you're an Illinois native.
Yes, I even went to the University of Illinois and graduated a long time ago, 1973.
These days you live in Oak Park, and you're a staff writer for the Chicago Reader. As a matter of fact, your work can be found on the Chicago Reader's website at www.chireader.com. You've also written an earlier book, Belfast Diary, War as a Way of Life. And you'll be appearing, I believe, this afternoon at 4 at the University of Illinois bookstore on Wright Street for a book signing and a reading.
That's right.
What focused you first on this topic?
I'd written this book on Northern Ireland, and my purpose in writing that book was to explain the conflict to Americans by explaining what it was like to live in a neighborhood where a lot of the conflict was played out on a daily basis. So I had moved into a community off the Falls Road in West Belfast and just tried to write about the neighborhood dynamics. And an editor, that was published by Beacon Press, and an editor, Knopf, read that book and asked me if I'd be interested in doing a book on torture. She wanted to do something about torture, thought a book would be helpful, didn't quite know how to shape it, but I think that she came to me because she thought that I might treat torture as a neighborhood in the same way that I treated Belfast and Northern Ireland as a neighborhood, and that I tried to look at the dynamics of the community and why people in various sections of the community did what they did, why a 19-year-old Catholic would pick up a gun and shoot a policeman when 19-year-old Catholics in Chicago and Boston don't typically do that. So that was what got me started.
Your book looks at three different incidents of torture, and one of them is in Northern Ireland with the British government. Another one is in Israel, and another one involves the Chicago police. Could you give just a brief summary of these three incidents?
Yes. The Northern Ireland case began in 1971. The British government decided to institute a policy called internment, which they'd used in Ireland before, and they arrested 342 Catholic men, and of those 342 on this one night, they were interned without charge, without any right of appeal. But of those 342, they chose 12 who were taken to a secret interrogation center, and they were then hooded. They were forced to stand spread-eagled against a wall so that all their weight was on their, a lot of their weight was on their hands, and they were deprived of food, deprived of sleep. They were subjected to a constant noise, a white noise, and they were beaten. And when they moved their hands or when they fell off the wall, and they were not allowed to use the toilet. So this lasted for about a week, and it literally drove some of them crazy. And so that was the first case. I chose that one because I thought that I could find the men 20 years after it happened. I started this book a long time ago, and that I could. It was sort of like a control group of men, because it's not unusual for a torturer to choose different techniques for different people, and here were 12 men who were tortured all at once using the same methods. The second case is a case in Israel of some men who were ordered to break the arms and legs of some Palestinians during the Intifada. And the men were from the left. They were kibbutzniks, socialist land for peace types, and they got the order and they went about trying to do it as best they could. And they took these Palestinians into, in the first case, they took them into an olive grove and tried to break their arms and legs with clubs. And in rifle butts. And in the second case, they took them into a field and did the same thing. What interested me was that it sort of guided the idea of blind obedience to authority, because these weren't the kind of men who you would ordinarily expect to do that. And the third case from Chicago was the case of it came out as a result of a shooting of two policemen in 1982. A man named Andrew Wilson shot dead two policemen, and he was arrested after 5 days on the run. And when he emerged from the police station, he had these peculiar marks on his ears in the shape of alligator clips. It looked like a little crocodile had come up and bit him. And he claimed that he'd been subjected to electric shock, that he'd been burned and beaten. And the policeman he was accusing was a well-decorated policeman, a hero from Vietnam. And during the course of Wilson's civil suit, some anonymous letters started arriving at the offices of Wilson's attorneys saying that other men had been subjected to the same technique and that they should talk to a man named Melvin Jones at Cook County Jail. And when they found Jones, Jones said the same thing had happened to him and was able to lead them to transcripts in which Jones had said that back in 1982. And he led them to other men who in turn led them to other men. And over the course of several years, they built up a list of 62 people who had been tortured using various means at Area 2 under the command of John Burge. And what interested me about that case was, first of all, it was my hometown, and secondly, I thought it got at the issue of what we mean when we say we're against torture. I think really most people who say that, what they really mean is that they're against the torture of people they like. And when it comes to someone whom they don't like, they don't really care all that much.
Mm-hmm. So these are, each of these cases has something different about them. But perhaps the one thing that struck me is that they're all in the context of governments, which for a lot of people are the good guys.
Yes.
The British government, the Israeli government, and the police looked upon favorably by people in general. But torture was used here in all of these cases fairly widely.
Yes, I chose these three cases because when I started this project, people were asking me, was I going to Chile, was I going to Argentina or South Africa? And I realized that most Americans think that torture is done in some sort of backward civilization, as you said in your introduction. And I had gradually come to the belief that it actually was done by very ordinary people and by governments just like ours, by people like us. So that's why I chose these three cases.
You talked to many of the people who directly administered the torture in all three of these cases, and you examined how they approached this. And what sort of people were they?
Well, the Israelis were very thoughtful men. The captain who gave the order, I'm sorry, there was a colonel, I'm confusing listeners, a colonel gave the order to a captain and the captain passed it on to two lieutenants. The colonel gave the order and left the scene. The captain said to his two lieutenants, this is what we're going to do. We're going to break arms and legs, but I'm not going to do it. I'm going to stay here at the bus. And so the two lieutenants then carried it out. So I interviewed one of the lieutenants and the captain and the colonel, all of whom were very, you know, there wasn't anything, you know, I think we all expect that horns will pop out and they'll appear to be diabolical, but they were nothing of the sort. Lieutenant who directly administered it and oversaw the beatings looked me right in the eye and told me exactly what he'd done. And I asked him, when you left the field, when you left these guys in the field, what condition did you think they were in? And he said, I thought they'd never walk again. And he recognizes the captain and said something to me that was interesting. He said, you know, when we sit in this room here, this order is a monster, but I can tell you that in that time, in that place, it did not seem that way. And nobody had ever told him about manifestly illegal orders, which you are obligated to disobey. And He got the order and he carried it out.
Mm-hmm. In the case of, that was the case in Israel, in the case of Northern Ireland?
Northern Ireland, the British refused to identify the people who carried out the torture. They did not cooperate with the European Commission on Human Rights, which was investigating it, and so by not putting torturers on the stand, they effectively prevented those men from testifying as to who gave them the orders. And the there was ample evidence to support the idea that the orders came from cabinet level.
And with the Chicago Police?
The Chicago Police were led by John Burge, who I interviewed. And he struck me as somebody whom I might have seen at a family picnic of mine, and the sort of fellow who would, you know, if my elderly aunt had arrived and her car wouldn't start, he'd be the first guy out there trying to get it going for her. And he, you know, was a very good policeman who, you know, was very good at what he did, but basically tortured people. I don't think there's any question of that anymore. I reported in 1990, and since then others have come to accept that idea, and he was thrown off the force in 1993, and we still have 10 men on death row who are there on the basis of suspect confessions that he or his men took. But he struck me as another ordinary man.
Mm-hmm. The people you talked to or other people who you examined or saw testimony or other statements from, did everybody stand up for their actions? Did anybody have regrets for the action?
Yes. The Uruguayan torturers I interviewed, aside from the cases that we've mentioned here, I interviewed torturers from other countries as well, Greeks, two Greeks, two Uruguayans, a Rhodesian, another Israeli, and an American who tortured in Vietnam. And several of them had regrets about what they had done. The Uruguayans were now living in Scandinavia, and one in Norway, one in Sweden. And the fellow in Sweden was completely isolated. His family was the only Uruguayan family in the town in which he lived, and he couldn't go back home because he had talked about what he'd done, and he'd been given political asylum. And he had regrets, first of all, about torturing. He did not have any regrets about having talked about it because he felt like he had cleared his conscience in so doing. And that was typical also of the other Uruguayan who lived in Uruguay. I mean, I'm sorry, lived in Norway. The American who tortured in Vietnam, he had regrets that he had done it. But he pled to be understood in the context of the situation. And once you start to think about the context of the situation, you can sort of see how one can come to do it. Here's a 18, 19-year-old kid. In his case, he comes out of Detroit. He's been trained as an interrogator. He arrives in Vietnam. The first interrogation he witnesses is of a man who's a Viet Cong suspect who's about to be evacuated by helicopter. His leg has been blown off. He's being interrogated. The major doesn't like the answers that the man is giving, and the major steps up and takes over the interrogation and starts poking the man's wounds with a pencil. This scene is witnessed by higher-ranking officers, doctors, nurses. Nobody says a word. This was just the milieu. This was just the way it was done. And here's this, basically this kid who's completely dependent on his superiors to tell him how to do things, how to survive. And they say this is the way it's done. And he picked it up.
There is that succession there from the people who are following orders from from the people who are giving the orders, and how does it start? How does the decision get made that torture will be used?
Well, that's difficult to answer in some ways, because in some cases, when you try to trace the path of responsibility, it becomes more and more difficult. The colonel in the Israeli case, for example, says his name is Yehuda Meir. He says, "I got the orders from Yitzhak Rabin." Yitzhak Rabin was defense minister. He had said publicly that he would suppress the Intifada with force, might, and beatings. And Meir said to the soldiers, he said, "Break their arms and legs." And other high-ranking soldiers took the stand and said, "Yes, Mayor," Rabin said, "break their arms and legs." Rabin himself said, "I didn't say break bones, I just said beat." And you might argue that's a pretty fine distinction, but it, in terms of prosecution, it is a, you know, unless you have hard evidence, there really would be no way to prosecute Yitzhak Rabin. Nor is there much will to prosecute a cabinet-level person in any nation. So oftentimes orders that are very clear to a soldier on the front line seem to get grayer and grayer as they go up the chain of command.
In all these cases, torture was ordered or initiated with some goal in mind.
Yes, but not always information. I think people in this country often assume that torture is done to get information, but often it's done to intimidate a community or to punish. And in the Israeli case, it was done basically to punish. They had suppressed a riot in, or a, it was a demonstration with stone throwing and burning tires, and they were given a list of names of people. They arrested them, and they had no idea what these men were accused of doing, but they were then ordered to break their arms and legs. So they assumed they were being punished for some act that these men had committed. Mm-hmm. And it's not atypical that a torturer doesn't know what the victim is accused of doing, that the torturer's job is simply to torture, and somebody else might even be doing the interrogation.
We're talking with John Conroy. He's a staff writer with the Chicago Reader and the author of the new book, Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People, The Dynamics of Torture. And we have one caller who's been waiting very patiently. Line one calling in from Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. My question deals with when does torture begin, and it, as opposed to non-physical abuse, do you regard mental strains as being torture as well? For example, in the news recently, we had Wen Ho Lee, who was kept in solitary confinement and chained for very long periods of time, and then the judge refused to have him released from that kind of confinement, and to in his perception, I can very well imagine, he thought he could be there forever, and so is that regarded as torture? And how much does it take to induce a confession?
Well, the UN definition of torture seems fairly specific, but actually, as this caller gets to the point, that it's not so easily applied when you get into the real world. So that the use of solitary confinement, which some people are not bothered by, can actually drive others mad. And so torture becomes very hard to oftentimes becomes very hard to define, and in this case, I can't make that call. It could be, it could not. It would depend, I suppose, on the effect on the victim. Although, you know, I'd be willing to hear the argument that any kind of solitary confinement is tantamount to torture. How much does it take to get a confession? It really depends on the individual. Some people confess at the mere threat of torture, so that You can simply take out the machinery and set it down in front of someone, and that's the end of it. They'll confess to anything you want them to confess to. And other people can withstand a great deal of stress and physical pain. And, you know, I think that it really varies from person to person.
You do mention some types of, I guess, psychological torture, from sleep deprivation, which could be a physical kind, to things such as mock executions, in which people are essentially led through the process of an execution, which never quite happens at the last moment. And do you see long-term effects when you've looked at some of the victims of these?
Interestingly, the one long-term study of torture victims concluded that the best predictor of post-traumatic stress disorder being long-lasting in a victim was long-term starvation and mock execution. And that combination in particular was particularly difficult for people to withstand. What was the... I'm forgetting the second part of your question there.
Do you see long-lasting effects from these?
Yes. You know, the effects of torture can last basically somebody's whole life. There are torture victim treatment clinics in various cities throughout the United States now, and they help people deal with this sort of thing. But it's, you know, for a lot of people, it's a very long haul.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller in, and we're talking to Line 2 from Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, good morning. The worst torture I ever heard about, I can't even recount what happened, but it was a tale of ancient China, actually, and one of the empresses getting rid of one of her rivals. That just sends chills up my spine even when I think about it. But I was going to ask your guest there if he had emailed that to Chicago Reader, because I'd like to send him a copy of a article I read called "Torture in the American Gulag." It's written by Tom Cahill. Would you have?
I'd be happy to look at it. My email is jconroy329@aol.com. JCONROY329 at AOL.com.
Okay, the main thrust of his article, and this guy was a activist in the 60s, and he talked about the way prison officials would use male rape, the rape of prisoners, as a means of torture, and he makes claims such as that more men are raped in prisons every day than women, far more, and it's actually manipulated by prison officials, and in some cases the FBI. If they want to neutralize somebody, they'll plant the idea with the other prisoners that the guy's a child molester or something like that. You know, and I really think that's an angle, or having to do with kind of like the definition of torture, that really ought to be included in your discussions. But I myself don't know that much about it. But I will email you this, and I hope you do read it.
Thanks. The other caller asked about the definition. I have it here. The United Nations defines torture as any act by which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is intentionally inflicted by or at the instigation of a public official on a person for obtaining confession, for punishment, or intimidating him for other reasons. Torture constitutes an aggravated and deliberate form of cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment.
Oh, I want to double check. I got that right. jconroy329@aol.com.
That's right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, caller. And now we're going to Line 1 in Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Have you seen the movie Brazil?
A long time ago.
Yeah, I thought that that illustrated the point you're making very well. I mean, in fact, the torturer was even a friend of the protagonist who he was torturing. But even talking about his children and stuff like that, it's just very, very chilling.
I remember from that film, that's the Terry Gilliam movie, and Michael Palin plays the torturer, an old school friend of the main character, who seems to treat it as just another cheery civil servant cubicle job. Does that exist, or is it maybe a little more complex for people who do administer torture?
Well, it's not a cubicle job, but it is, in some cases, a job. The two Greeks I interviewed talked about how they would be just waiting, and then someone would be brought into the room, and they would warm them up. They torture them in various ways and then pass them on to the interrogator, not having known even the person's name. This is not atypical. An Israeli torturer who was interviewed by a friend of mine talked about how he would be in the room with an interrogator who spoke Arabic, and this man whom I'm talking about did not speak Arabic. So this interrogation would be going on. He had no idea what was being said, and periodically the interrogator would nod to him, and this guy would beat this guy bloody, knock out teeth and things, and then the interrogation would continue.
And people were able to do this and essentially go home and sleep at night and et cetera.
Well, you have to remember that people who do this believe that they are acting out the will of the community and that this is what the community supports and wants. And in most cases, I think that's true. I certainly look at the Chicago case, for example, that I talk about in my book. This has now been known about for 10 years that there have been these people tortured at Area 2. There's been no systematic attempt to find out how many. There's been no attempt to reinvestigate these cases. The detectives who served under Commander Burge, some of them are still in the force, some of them have been promoted. And the Chicago Press, the Tribune and the Sun-Times, did not call for an inquiry until 1999, which was which was 9 years after the allegations were public and 8 years after Amnesty called for an inquiry and 6 years after John Burge was thrown off the force.
And I want to thank you very much, caller, for your questions. And, of course, in the Chicago case, in the particular person that you're speaking of, Andrew Wilson, he's not exactly a poster boy for a torture victim. He was apparently a career criminal who really did murder a policeman in this case.
Yes, he murdered two policemen. There's no question about that. And it's not a question that the first time he was tried for the case, he was convicted with his confession. The Illinois Supreme Court threw that conviction out, and he was then tried again and convicted without the confession. They had plenty of evidence. They did not need to torture him to get the confession. And, in fact, this anonymous letter that I mentioned earlier said that he was tortured after he confessed.
Do you think in the public eye, when thinking about this is preferred to think that any physical abuse that went on was not that bad, or that the victims had it coming to them?
I think in every society there's a torturable class, a group of people whom we really don't care about, and in this case, the class is African-American suspected of violent crime, and in the Israeli case, it's Arabs, and in the Irish, the Northern Irish case, it's Irish Catholic nationalists. Mm-hmm.
You discuss a little bit in your book, essentially, the history of torture in society and how it develops, and I don't know if you're ever to pinpoint what gets torture started in a society. But you do talk about it as something that can grow in a society and come to affect more people.
Yes. Initially, I think people throughout history, torture has been used, and it often has been used in a way that initially had some limits on it so that certain classes would be exempt. But gradually, those distinctions are always blur, and eventually there is no exempt class, and and this happens over and over again. The torturable class keeps getting larger and larger.
Let's go ahead to another caller now. Line 2 is calling from Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. There's two, I guess they were experiments in terms of trying to figure out why people can do such things. One is the Stanley Milgram experiments. I believe that they took place in the late 40s, early 50s. And the second is this high school in California that did this, teacher did this experiment with some of his students called The Wave that turned into a TV show documentary.
The Stanford Prison Experiment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I was wondering what you think about such things, and are there ways that, I mean, how can people or children be taught that this is something that's not acceptable? These two experiments seem to be aimed at trying to come up with a way to teach people.
Let me describe to the listeners, first of all, what the two experiments were. In the Stanley Milgram experiments, which took place in the 60s at Yale, Milgram was a Yale psychologist, and he started off with a pilot study with Yale students. And he set up an instrument panel which looked very real and which had a series of switches on it indicating different levels of electric shock. And volunteers were brought into this room, and they were told that they were taking part in an experiment to test the effects of punishment on learning. And for every wrong answer that the other volunteer gave, volunteer A gave, volunteer B was going to flip a switch that gave him an electric shock. And as the person answered more questions wrong, the shocks got progressively worse. Now, Milgram found that that 60% of the people who, let me back up and say that there were no shocks actually given, that the one of the volunteers was actually a confederate of the experimenters. Milgram found that 60% of the people in this pilot study went on to give shocks all the way to the end of the scale, 450 volts, which said danger, severe shock, and he thereabout set about refining the experiment, thinking perhaps he had made some error, and he had the alleged victim screaming and crying about a heart condition, and he took the experiment out of Yale University and put it in a dingy office in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and he altered the distance between the teacher and the learner, and no matter what he did, people continued to obey at amazingly high rates as long as there was someone there in authority who said the experiment must continue. And the most shocking variation of this is one in which there were, if you can picture, there being three people in the room, one person receiving the shock, one person flipping the switches, and one person reading the questions. Now, the person reading the questions believed that, in this variation, believed they had no responsibility for the acts of the person flipping the switches, so that 37 out of 40, which is 92.5% of the people, went all the way to the end of the scale in that variation of the experiment. Briefly, the Stanford Prison Experiment, done by a man named Zimbardo, divided the a group of students into prisoners and guards, and over the course of 3 days, the prisoners took on the behavior of actual prisoners, and the guards took on increasingly abusive behavior, even though there was no reason for them to do so, and the experiment had to be stopped. This is different from the experiment that the man mentioned called The Wave, but it's I think it's the one that he meant to mention.
Mm-hmm. In these cases, and this really, I believe, also comes into the conclusion of your book, which I have to say is not an optimistic one as to what the opportunities are for reducing or eliminating torture in society, is that once it's there as a factor in society, there seems to be social forces which encourage people to do it, and people by their nature and by the social pressures they're under are inclined to go along with it.
Yes, as long as we... It's very difficult to disobey authority. Milgram shows, and Milgram's experiments have been repeated with similar results in other countries. And It's as long, and if you look at what happens in a torture situation, oftentimes, for instance, in Argentina, the torturer's actions were endorsed by the judiciary. They paid no attention to people who claimed to have been tortured. There were sometimes priests present, not on behalf of the victims, but on there because of the torturers. The superior officers signed off on kidnapping orders and things like that, so that you can see how somebody who is a torturer looks up and says, you know, these people are a whole lot smarter than I am, and they think it's fine, and there's no response, no great, you know, there were demonstrations from the, particularly the mothers of some of the people who disappeared in Argentina, but society as a whole went goes right along with it, and so it becomes easier to torture when you believe that you're being backed by the rest of your society.
Looking at these things historically, what causes a society to reduce or stop the use of torture?
A change in regime might cause that, and that is always a problematic situation because the new government is often an unstable government. They may depend on the military not to stage a coup, and in order to proceed with various democratic reforms they might want to introduce, they cannot then prosecute torturers. And in fact, sometimes liberation movements have engaged in torture themselves. The ANC, for example, in South Africa, they engaged in torture, and you know, not to the same extent that the government did, but no doubt, you know, no question that the ANC tortured people and that it was not mild torture, if there is such a thing. So when they come to power, you know, it's not so easy to say, well, everybody who tortured is going to get prosecuted because you're going to torture then some of your, I mean, you're going to prosecute some of your own people.
It doesn't sound like then that somebody takes a moral stance or that the idea passes through a society that this is the wrong way to conduct ourselves. We will not do this anymore.
Well, no, that idea is always present, and but getting the... But afterwards, basically, everyone wants to forget. Everyone wants to wipe the slate clean and start over again. Not everyone, of course, the victims and the families of the victims want some recognition that this happened and some punishment for the perpetrators as a way of guaranteeing that it won't happen again. But most times that doesn't happen.
We're talking with John Conroy, staff writer with the Chicago Reader and author of the book Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People, The Dynamics of Torture. It's a new publication of Alfred A. Knopf. John Conroy will be speaking, will be appearing this afternoon at the U of I bookstore at 4 p.m. today for a book signing and reading. Our number to call, we have time for two or three calls anyway at 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. We have a caller now calling in on line one from Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. I'd like to ask my question and then I'll hang up and listen.
Mm-hmm.
Given that women generally commit less heinous crimes than men do, do you know anything about the existence of women torturers, and would they be more likely to commit psychological torture, or would they be more likely to be an interrogator? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Women, in my mind, generally are not torturers, not because they're not capable of doing it, but because they lack advancement opportunity, I think, in military and police forces. Milgram, for instance, found equal rates of obedience among men and women. The Uruguayan torturers whom I interviewed, one of them mentioned that two women were members of his unit, and their job was to make sure that they did not go soft. One of their jobs was to make sure that the men did not go soft when they were torturing a woman. I don't know that there's any research that suggests that women would be more likely to engage in psychological torture than men. And so I'm not really competent to answer that question.
Let's go ahead to our next caller, line two from Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. This is an extremely interesting show. I wanted to go back to the reference made to lack of recourse to the courts in Argentina, and also to the fact that the cabinet had approved, or members of the cabinet at least, approved tortures in Israel. And I think, you know, we're talking about torture in two different contexts here. One, individuals, like the Milgram experiments, the individual psychology of it. But secondly, the institutional framework in which it takes place. And it seems to me that is the really crucial thing if one is going to try to stop torture. For example, the Israeli courts, until late last year, early this year, sanctioned the use of force in order to extract conventions. It was part of the institutional structure there. Also, if we look at the United States, how do we take into account that the judiciary almost never enters into the cases of prison conditions? In Marion, Illinois, we have people confined 23 hours a day in very, very small cells. Is that a torture or not? But the press doesn't question this. The penal system in the United States is just off limits to public scrutiny, from the county jail down up through federal penitentiaries. And there is an awful lot that goes on there that is cruel and unusual punishment. Is that is torture? What is the line between cruel and unusual punishment and torture? Also the case of the police. Mr. Birch hasn't gone to prison. It's very, very rare that the police departments, after people have tortured or brutalized other people, the city pays out civil penalties. And it's done. It's over with. There's no criminal accountability for people who commit the criminal acts of torture and cruel and unusual punishment. I'll stop and let you respond.
Well, I would agree with you, and that's sort of what I concluded, that torture is the perfect crime, that by and large only the victim pays. There are some exceptions, but very few. And the Israeli situation is very interesting because the Israeli government did allow torture until September. A little over a year ago.
Right.
And the interesting thing about that is that what the court decided was that torture was unconstitutional. And then the Likud faction decided that Israel, and many others also believe that Israel needed torture, and that so the Likud prepared a bill that was going to alter the Constitution so that torture would be allowed. However, the director of the Shin Bet in February, changed his position. He had previously argued that he needed torture, but then he argued, in exchange for getting more money for training for observation, technological, observation and techniques, equipment, computer equipment, et cetera. He dropped his request for this bill, and Israel has now been without torture, institutionalized torture, for a year. And there have been there's been nothing that's happened in Israel that, Israel hasn't fallen. It's in no great jeopardy.
Right.
And, you would think that Israelis would now be tearing their hair out saying, gee, we tortured tens of thousands of Palestinians for no reason. But on the other hand, they might argue, see, it worked.
Just one other thing about torture abroad and people thinking of torture elsewhere, like Argentina, El Salvador, or whatever. I think it's important also for people to understand that some of these torturers in the militaries of these countries and the police of these countries were trained in the United States to torture by the School of the Americas. I think Americans really need to take an introspective look about the role of the United States in torture here and abroad. Thank you.
Thank you, caller. We have time for one more call, I think, before we have to move on. And I want to say hello to Clinton, Indiana, on line four. Good morning. You're on Focus 580. Good morning. Are you with us?
Oh, yeah. I didn't think I was going to get in. Speaking of all this torture, reminds me, good friend of mine, shut up, dog. He was in, got captured in Vietnam, in South Vietnam by the Viet Cong. And on that short time that he was there, a prisoner, they'd stake him out naked at night, you know, no netting. And just before he was released or got freed, liberated, they cut off part of his tongue. And that's all. I just thought I'd mention it.
Thank you, caller. That seems to be, I think, an aspect which also runs through your book. There are certain goals that some torture seems to be aimed at, and some other torture which just seems to be out of simple cruelty for its own sake. And is there a goal, so to speak, when that is done?
Well, I think there's a sort of the UN altered its definition to account for. In 1984, I believe the definition I read earlier was from 75, but to account for discrimination and I think that this sort of cruelty is somehow indicative of that. The torturer looks down. It's very difficult to torture someone whom you regard as your equal. So typically, torturers regard the people whom they're torturing as some sort of subhuman class, and they're referred to as, you know, by various derogatory names. They're gooks, they're niggers, they're, you know, paddies, they're Arabs, they're Jews, they're whatever, terrorists, they're communists, or friends of communists, or whatever. And so I think that even though there was no reason to, for instance, cut off this part of this man's tongue, the interrogations were over, nonetheless, it is sort of part of the punishment and part of the discrimination that is a pattern of torture anyway.
I think I have time for one more very brief question for you, and that is, you know, given what I think seems to be the basically pessimistic view at the conclusions of this book, is it worth it to try to combat the presence of torture?
Oh, there's no question that it's worth it. I think that human rights organizations have had a tremendous effect in terms of raising the level of consciousness of millions of people as to what is acceptable human behavior by governments and by individuals. And I think that now there's a movement to hold torturers to account. There's a group out in California, the CJA, is it the Committee for Justice and Accountability? Anyway, it's working to prosecute torturers in this country who did their jobs elsewhere, and this, there are groups like this all over the world now.
John Conroy is the author of Unspeakable Acts: Ordinary People, The Dynamics of Torture. It's published by Alfred A. Knopf. You can meet John Conroy today at the University of Illinois Bookstore on Wright Street. He'll be there at 4 p.m. for a book signing and reading. And John, I want to thank you very much for coming in with us this morning.